since 1935, the goal was to enlarge this Social Security. But now we are living through a period where the goal is, quote, to privatize and end Social Security. So there is a war against the poor. And we're living through, one could even argue, we're really having basically a civil war. And one of the ways you can see that is if you just focus for a bit on homelessness. It fascinated me as a biographer that Eleanor Roosevelt, who was orphaned at 10, and it's sort of interesting, how did Eleanor Roosevelt become such a great hero, a great leader of people, a great-hearted, compassionate woman who identified with people in want, in need, in trouble, with people on the margins of life. Every time she visited a woman's prison, she would say things like, I could have been any one of the women on the inside. Well, where did she get that level of empathy? Of course, it might have meant also that she too could have killed her husband. I was never quite sure what that meant. But she had this great empathy, and where it came from, in my opinion, was that her father, who was her most beloved person in her life, Elliot, was a drop-dead alcoholic. In fact, he dropped dead at the age of 34. Now, we all know folks who drink too much, they're in their 70s and 80s already. Imagine how much you have to drink to die at the age of 34. And her mother, bitter and weary, died at the age of 29. She essentially turned her face to the wall and died. Eleanor was 8 when her mother died and 10 when her father died. And after that, she never lived in a home of her own. Her uncle, Theodore Roosevelt, was president. She was well-placed with aunts and uncles and a wonderful grandmother who really arguably saved her life and sent her away to school in England at a place called Allenswood, where she received a very wonderful education. And a measure of her life, I think, is really rooted in this great place of liberal, spirited, feminist education, where Eleanor became a star and really a great intellect. Although people actually have said to me, don't you think she's stupid? I mean, people have actually said that to me. But she spoke many languages. And she said at the end of her life, when she was 76, she wrote a memoir, You Learn by Living. And she said, the happiest day of my life was the day that I made the first team at field hockey. Yay, Title IX. I really paused a lot over that wonderful athletic reality. After her entire life at the United Nations, she knew everybody in the world. She did everything. She had so many struggles and triumphs. The happiest day of her life was the day that she made the first team at field hockey. And I really felt I understood her as a result of that. Eleanor Roosevelt was a team player. She's the one who always said, never go anywhere without your gang. And she loved sports, knockabout, sweaty, athletic sports. A team player. And her sport of choice was politics. She hated to lose. She always advised her friends, if you have to compromise, be sure to compromise up, which is very good advice. And she never turned her back on a struggle or a fight or a battle. And it really fascinated me, ultimately. Eleanor Roosevelt was a very competitive woman. And that became not competitive in the bad sense, I win, you lose, there go your eyes, but in the good sense, personal best, we got to win this one for the team, we got to win this one for the community, we've got to make it better. But also competitive. When she held her first press conferences for women journalists only, because her great friend, wonderful reporter, Lorena Hickok, called Hick, said, why don't you have press conferences for women journalists only? They're the first fired and the last hired during this Great Depression. Eleanor Roosevelt did. She agreed to do that. And then at the end of the first press conference, she called Hick and said, it was great. It was a very wonderful affair. I'll go on with him. And the best news is I even beat Franklin. He's not having his press conference until next week. And then, to follow this competitive theme, it fascinated me that she gave herself the task, the first year as First Lady, of earning as much as FDR earned as president. She wanted to earn as much as her husband. He earned $75,000, $1,933. If you multiply by a factor of 10, that's a lot of money, you get how much he earned as president. And she insisted on earning the same, which she did, as a radio journalist and a columnist. And at the end of the year, wrote a friend, I've done it. I've earned as much as Franklin. And she did every year until the end of the White House years. And then after that, of course, she earned much more. She was what we might call, indeed, a workaholic. And then if you look at his court, her court, they survived the Lucy Mercer affair. You've probably heard about the Lucy Mercer affair. That was very early on, World War I. They survived that, and their marriage was intact. And then he brought in Missy LeHand into the White House. In 1920, into their homes. They were not yet in the White House. They weren't even yet in the State House. But she lived with them, FDR's live-in companion, in all of their homes to the end of her life. And Eleanor Roosevelt was always very gracious and warm to Missy LeHand, treated her with respect and affection, much as, you know, a medieval household, the second wife, the junior wife. But Eleanor Roosevelt, real key to this, was that she wrote an article in 1923 called The Women of Tibet, in which she said, it has been brought to my attention that the women of Tibet have many husbands, which seems to me a very good thing, since so many husbands have so many wives. So, you know, that explains, as far as I'm concerned, Eleanor Roosevelt's growing commitment to the other people in her life, beginning with Earl Miller. This is in Volume 1, and no doubt, Lorena Hickok, everyone called Hick. You got to read to see the details. You got to read the book. But Eleanor Roosevelt, after her parents died, never lived in a home of her own. She always lived in other people's houses. And so it fascinated me that this woman who lived first with her grandmother and then away at school in England and then in her mother-in-law's homes, which she hated, chose, and then in what she always called public institutions, the State House and the White House, chose as her commitment decent, affordable, excellent housing for all people. And that was her commitment. And she worked with a guy named Senator Robert Wagner, who is the author of the first really good public housing law and public housing authority, to get really good, decent housing for all people. And one of my favorite chapters in Volume 2 is a chapter about a place called Arthurdale. And Arthurdale is a rural community way up in the mountains of Appalachia in Preston County, West Virginia. And a lot of folks were saying, why are we going to spend all this money on building really nice houses for these miners and former miners, many of whom were unionists and had been blacklisted in the 1920s and were out of work. And why this community was chosen is because they were out of work from 1927, when they were blacklisted because they were called Reds, because they were unionists, until 1933, and they were living in caves and culverts. And Eleanor Roosevelt was told, you want to see the worst place in Depression America, where folks are starving to death and living in caves, come on down here to Preston County. And she went down and she said, we're going to get these people out of these caves by Christmas. And she said, we're going to build model houses. It's going to be model home building, what we now call sustainable community. And every house will be different. And every house will be on 2 to 5 acres. And they can build their own houses. All the government has to do is buy the land, and this can be, you know, a multi-source housing development, but it will be nice. It'll have all modern conveniences, electricity, toilets, indoor plumbing, all modern, a refrigerator, and it will be, there'll be rhododendron, it'll be planted in rhododendron and mountain laurel. And Harold Ickes, the father of the Harold Ickes you know about today, said, if Eleanor has her way, how are we going to tell the rich from the poor? And Eleanor Roosevelt said, well, in matters of such simple dignity and decency, we should not have to tell the rich from the poor. And the issue was indoor toilets. They really objected to that. But they were built. These houses were built the way Eleanor Roosevelt said they must be built. And everybody called this a failure. But I went down there with my partner. And we went down. This is, from the point of view of the people in this community, it's a total success. 83% of the original settlers still live there. Their children and grandchildren still live there. Everybody works. Everybody went to school. It's a community of activists in what is still, it's called the Rust Belt now. It's still a benighted and impoverished community. So this is a center of hope. And we could build off the Dales all over the country. But not one single federal dollar has been invested in new housing starts since Ronald Reagan. Not since Ronald Reagan. Not one single penny in new housing starts. And so we have a homeless crisis, a great tragedy. And I know it's time to stop, but it's why we have to keep organizing and go door to door with all the great vision that's out there. And there's some really great vision out there. And a lot of it is coming right from the community. It's percolating up. We need each other. The good news is we have each other. Thank you very much.
That was historian Blanche Wiesen Cook. You're listening to On Welcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fender Syracuse.
Everybody know the dice were loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows that the bull's leaking. Everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and the long stem rose. Everybody knows.
Our final speaker will be Doris Haddock, more commonly known as Granny D, who began at age 89 a cross-country walk to call for campaign financing reforms.
Welcome to the Cortland County Independent Forum. Once again, we thank the Unitarian Universalists for kindly allowing us to use this historic building, Cortland's old cobblestone church, for our lectures by early 21st century American reformers. The best introduction to today's speaker and the story of how she joined the ranks of America's leading reformers can be found in her own book, Granny D, Walking Across America in My 90th Year. This is a splendid book about what turns out to be a spiritual journey. It is a book that ultimately requires the reader to think about his or her own spiritual journey. I'm using the word spiritual to refer to our true experience as living, breathing beings, children of God, if you will, before selfishness, greed, and fear come to cloud our vision. In this sense, a spiritual path is a way of living that requires us to continually strive to face the realities of our existence in a way that offers us the satisfaction and happiness that come when we live fearlessly and selflessly in the service of other sentient beings. Like many spiritual journeys, the one described in this book starts out in the desert of the American Southwest. The hero, heroine, is a bit lost, uncertain, and confused. And I'll confess the reader may feel the same in the beginning. The confusion and pain of life is very much present. But as the journey continues and the heroine leaves the strange and beautiful desert of the American Southwest with its vividly colored roadkill and enters the American South, home of American literature, wonderful, coherent stories about her life and experiences begin to unfold, and we come to feel that we know her as well as we know any of our friends. And we rejoice for her when her persistent transcontinental effort to place one foot in front of the other at the age of 89 begins to inspire and encourage others and to give hope to those who have felt hopeless in the face of the financial corruption that had taken deep root in the highest circles of our government. A journey that began as an act of desperation by someone depressed and grieving for the loss of friends and loved ones becomes a transcendent experience of the happiness that comes from living fearlessly and being of real service to others. Not to make light of this journey, I think it began when Doris Haddock, a thoughtful, lifelong activist, wrote to her congressman about an issue of concern and received one of those stupid computer letters in reply. At that point, I think she felt strongly that her congressman cared only about how much cash was in his campaign war chest and what voting blocks he had lined up, and was not in the least interested in what she thought or said about anything. I suspect she said something like this to herself: "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it any longer." And off she went on what turned out to be a spiritual journey. Please welcome our speaker today, who came here all the way from Dublin, New Hampshire, to be with us, Doris Haddock, Granny D.
Thank you, Robert. That was a wonderful introduction. Robert was really worried that no one would come because it's such a lovely day. I brought you this beautiful day, and maybe they'd all want to be outdoors enjoying it. One of the things that happened as I walked across 3,200 miles, as I came to each state, they would say to me, "Which one do you think is the most beautiful?" And I would say, "This one, of course." But I have to tell you that I have fallen in love with New York town, New York State. It is so beautiful. I think of all those five nations across your state, those five Indian nations. I have been an admirer of Francis Parkman for many years. I have all of his. In fact, I have a son-in-law who overheard somebody talking about Francis Parkman at a very fashionable cocktail party in Washington, D.C. And he said to my husband, "Have you ever heard of Francis Parkman?" And I said to my husband, and he said, of course I have. "Let's go and see if we can find these books that in the secondhand store that were written way back in 1800. And they brought them home, all of the volumes. And so I know all about everything that happened here in New York in the old days. And if you are not familiar with Frances Parkman, do go and get it from the library, because there are wonderful stories about New York State. When I was 89 years old, I went to my son. I want to squash the rumor that I came from a home for the aged. I did not. But when I went to my son and said to him, I would like to walk across the country. I have not been able to make a dent in what is going on here, and I want my great 16 great-grandchildren to be brought up in a democracy, and we're fast becoming a fascist state. And he said, walk across the country? And I said, yes. He said, Mother dear, you're an old woman. You live on Social Security. You live in a town of 1,400. Whatever in the world makes you think you can even make a dent? And I said, I don't know, but I have to do it. He said, very well, if you follow the regime that I will set up for you, I will consider letting you go. You know, when you're 89, they become your parents. So, after a year, I had walked and done all the things he told me I had to do. I went to him and I said, now I'm going. I didn't say, may I go? I said, now I'm going. And so he, being a very kind soul, was really the one that made it possible for me to walk across these countries, plus all the hundreds of people that helped me. Because I walked as a pilgrim, I did live on Social Security, and I knew that the only way I was going to make it was to walk until given shelter, fasting until given food. And I never, never had to sleep on the ground, and I never missed a meal, because we have wonderful people in this country, wonderful people. But friends, today, our sister and brother citizens believe that their voices in government are drowned out by floods of special interest money. And they are right. No one seriously argues that point anymore. The flood is too great, and the preoccupation of candidates and officials with fundraising fully eclipses the interest of everyday constituents. Now, with Enron as an example, our citizens are beginning to be even more aware of the corruption that is happening in our government, both state and federal. They are appalled at the amounts of money they see raised and spent on our election campaigns. Friends, we have recently celebrated an important day in the annual cycle of our great republic. I'm not speaking of July the 4th, the day of our independence, but April 15th, the day of our interdependence, the day the McCain-Feingold Shazmian Bill was passed, the day of our shared commitment to each other to make this government work. We aren't crazy about taxes and paying them. If we think we are being asked to pay unfairly, what we dislike most, and this goes way back to a moment on the docks of Boston Harbor, is to be taxed as a full player when we are not being fairly represented in the decisions of supposedly equal people. Taxation without representation is a term often heard in about high taxation, but I would like to invoke it today to emphasize the other side of the equation, the lack of representation we are receiving for our tax dollars. We taxpayers find ourselves shouldering the burdens while wealthy special interests are able to avoid paying taxes, shifting their fair share. And plus many of the costs of their own businesses, such as environmental cleanup, onto working people. This goes quite beyond taxation without representation. For the problem is not so much that our interests are being neglected, but that our interests are being squarely attacked and damaged while we subsidize our attackers. It is un-American in all its aspects. The dark heart of this treachery is the current campaign finance system, where special interests simply buy public policies aimed against us with their campaign donations. This is not the normal condition of our political history. This is not inevitable. It is now being practiced on an open, brazen, and massive scale, and it is cancerous to the underpinnings of a fair, free, and civil society. History is repeating itself. This is not the first time we have been faced with this problem. In 1864, President Abraham Lincoln warned us against enthroning the corporations or an era of corruption in high places would follow. And in 1907, President Teddy Roosevelt stated, "Our government, both state and national, must be freed from the sinister influence or control of special interests. There can be no effective control of corporations while their political activity remains. To put an end to it will be neither a short nor an easy task, but it can be done." Senator McCain and Bill Bradley, both running for president in 2000 in New Hampshire, said in effect, "A poor man today must sell his soul in order to run for office, or he has to be a multimillionaire. He must sell his future votes to bring money interests in order to gain the enormous funds needed to run a campaign." And that is not, ladies and gentlemen, my idea of democracy. We have this year won a modest victory by pushing a new law, the McCain-Feingold Bill, and it is going to work. It is really going to work. And we are going to be, once again, a democracy. We want to do this because we feel that there is no other way, and that a similar bill has been passed by four states. They are Maine, Massachusetts, Arizona, and Vermont. And they are working, because Arizona and Maine have had an election, and they have found that their all of their brochures, all of their bills for voting are filled up with people who are obligated to no one. And they find that those people, the only one that is necessary for them to be obligated to are the people that elected them. It's a little system we call a democratic republic, and it is worth trying here in New York. We must provide public fundings for our public election. Why? Because only the public financing of campaigns provides a dramatic and fundamental correction to the present system. Let us look at the reasons why some may resist this reform. First, some anti-reformers say that the taxpayers' money should not go to candidates. After all, some of the candidates are people we could never vote for. So why would we want to support their campaigns with our tax dollars? Of course, we support all kinds of people we do not approve of with our tax dollars, starting with our prison budgets. We do not support them. We support a system that provides for a functioning society. Our tax dollars are used to print the names of our political foes on our ballots. Our tax dollars provide for the primary elections of parties we disagree with. We do all this in the name of democracy. It is an expensive affair. It is the infrastructure of our public decision-making system. This is an improvement in efficiency that ought to appeal to New Yorkers. Let me say it again. If we directly fund our political campaigns on the theory that the citizens need information about the candidates, then we can save 9 out of 10 tax dollars. For we will not have to provide for the tax loopholes and special benefits that fat cat campaign contributors now demand from lawmakers in exchange for their campaign donations. If you are a political conservative, would you not trade corrupt system for public financing for a clean one that costs the taxpayers 1/10 as much? Is that not the essence of smaller, more efficient government? Wouldn't any American trade a corrupt system that deprives Americans of their proper representation and therefore their fundamental political freedom for a reformed system that makes our politics once again the arena of our ideas and not our billfolds? And if you were a patriot, would you dare send off your children to war to bravely defend a system of corrupt special interest influence? To do it would break your heart. To honor the people who've given their lives in service to our democracy, can we not agree that the present system of organized corruption would not be what they died for and ought to be set aside for a clean democracy? It might occur to you that another approach would be to find a new class of candidates who cannot be bought. We must, however, understand that the very best of us are soon co-opted and then corrupted by the horrible expenses of political campaigning. We must stop putting good people in ethically corrosive environments where they eventually become financial Frankensteins who care only for the next grotesque donation to keep themselves alive. It is up to us, you and me, for that is what we mean by a democracy, to design effective systems that will bring out the best in our people through institutions that will provide us fair representation, freedom, and equality. In this reform battle, you and I fight for the position of the individual, for our friends, for our family. As you know, the Enron affair is only the latest in a very long string of scandals that have discredited the idea that special interest money can be taken without the corruption of the system. The public feels that the little guy that worked at Enron is the injured party. those thousands of employees whose retirement plan was based on company stock. They are faced not only with a lost job, but their savings for their future retirement. Many wonder whether Enron is only the tip of the iceberg, and whether the country is in danger of another crash like that of 1929. Are you worried, as some are, when they talk about putting Social Security money into the stock market, gambling our future nest egg? Having lived through the 1929 stock crash, don't forget, at the age of 92, I have lived through one-third of our American history. And the depression that followed that stock market crash affected all of us. Go look at the line of ragged-dressed, snot-nosed, cold, shivering men waiting in the blue morning light for a cup of soup in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Memorial Park in Washington, D.C., that has just been opened in the last year. If you want to see what a depression looks like, I walked by such a line of men in my 19th year when Franklin Square House to Copley Plaza was where I lived in Boston, going to Emerson College. It is not easy. It is not easy to change a government. And you have to have fortitude and guts in order to do it, and in order to stay the course. But Gandhi changed a nation, King changed a nation, and you can too. Don't let anyone tell you it can't be done. You may not win the first time, but you will not have lost if you push the idea ahead a few inches, ready for a second assault. Remember, where you stand is the center of the world. And you can do anything if you get your family and friends and neighbors behind you. Because your fellow citizens love this country, are proud of being an American, are proud of New York, are proud of this country and its democracy. They are proud to be the greatest country in the world, and they don't like to believe that there is corruption in their government, that a man has to sell his votes in order to run for office, to become elected for the U.S. Senate. It has been estimated that an incumbent must raise the equivalent of $4,000 a day, every single day, 7 days a week, every one of the 6 years of his office. How would you like to be a senator and go to bed wondering, where can I find that $4,000 tomorrow? Great things have been accomplished in the States. Women's right to vote began in Wyoming, and it was 5 years before it became federal law. Think of all the laws that were started in the States by Frank Delano Roosevelt. They called him a socialist. They called him a communist, but he started unemployment insurance and workmen's compensation in the States. Social Security started in the States. And when we get public funding in the States, the federal government will follow. When you are my age, you will understand that the voice you must listen to is that small one within you, telling you to save this planet, to leave a decent legacy to our children. Do not fail to appreciate the magical moments of life. Fully participate in it fully and constructively, never giving an inch to injustice, unfairness, or inequality, nor ever forgetting the long line of people we have known and loved in the great circle that extends well into the next life. What a wonderful, challenging time in which we live. A time when we all have so much important work to do in taking back our freedom from the corporate world that has been created. To be able to establish in this state of New York the fact that money ceased to be the criteria of which and who shall become state officers, and honest vision and character will once again be what we look for in a candidate. There are 40 of our 50 states working towards enactment of a new way of government. Let New York adopt that way of government, which will give us better services for the taxes we pay. Let New York State be number 5 with a clean election system. Thank you.
Questions? Yes. Doris would be happy to take your questions.
No, it's not the least bit disappointing to me. He asks, is the McCain-Feingold bill working in the right direction, or is it a disappointment? It is a disappointment in that, you know, politics is compromise. Now, can you all hear me from here? Good. It's compromise. And this is what they had to do in order to get it passed. They had been working on the McCain-Feingold bill, Shays-Mian, which is the sister of the McCain-Feingold bill, so therefore becomes the McCain-Feingold bill, ever since Watergate. And they couldn't move it that far. And the reason they couldn't move it that far was because they would not compromise. They finally had to compromise. And what they did was, all the bad money, all the loop, all it's all gone. That's it. And they're out there like a pack of hungry hounds trying to get money for this next election because it's over. The bill becomes enacted at the end of this next election. What they had to do was you can give $1,000, you know you can give $1,000 legally to a candidate. They upped that $1,000 to $2,000. And what they're saying, we're going to be awash with money. That's true. But we will see then, at last, we must have public funding. If you still see all that money and say, what in the world are we going to do? You know, Paul Wellstone has a wonderful bill, all ready to go. And it doesn't take a week. It takes about a week to get a bill passed. If you're in favor of it, you can argue about it one day and get it in there. And that is what is going to happen in my way of thinking. And that's why I in the beginning we had a conference. All the organizations had a big telephone conference, and they said, we will only go up to 1,500. We all agree, up to 1,500. Well, they weren't walking around the Capitol as I was. They were talking with all the senators, as I was, who said, Doris, it's got to be. This is the way it's got to be. Do you want this or nothing? I said, I want it. And and that's the way it was enacted, with 2,000 rather than 1,000. However, there's no other, PERG, who is the outfit that's run by, that was started by NADA, castigated me, said, Doris, why did you do it? You promised. I said, I'm sorry, but politics is compromise. You weren't there. You didn't know the fever that was going on and the excitement that they really were going to make it. They were going to do it, and it was 2:30 in the morning. They worked all, at the end, they worked all day long until 2:30 in the morning, and I sat in the gallery and watched them, and when it was over, they looked up at me and they went like this. So naturally, I thought it was wonderful, but I know it's wonderful because I know it's the beginning. It's turning a corner, and on it you can build what you need to build. Because with all that money, that's all going to be gone. The $1,000 is going to be gone. The $2,000 is going to be gone when you have public funding. Because everybody gets the same amount of money. You're all on a playing field, an even playing field, and that's it. And your money won't buy you anything. Your ideas and your vision will, yes.
I just wondered how, if it was publicly financed, if somebody that was a multi-millionaire, could they still finance their own?
They cannot use their own money. In all of the states, they cannot use their own money. And those that did, the public said, he's trying to buy the election. And they didn't win. And that's what happened. And we had Arizona and Maine. And I was in Minneapolis talking to the General Assembly there. And there were two men from Maine. They have become ambassadors. And they had passed. They had won their elections in Maine. One of them was an incumbent, a Democrat, and he went right for it. The other one was a Republican, had never held an office in his life. And he went for it, and he made it. And they were thrilled with a lot of, I met a lot of women along the way. I was in what's called the Shadow Convention that Arianna Huffington set up during the general election last time, and there were a couple of women there, and I don't know how they came out, but they said to me in the green room, you made us do this. I said, what are you talking about? They said, we dared to do it because in Maine, you know, anybody can run if they can get out and win a certain amount of donations from the people that will elect them. There, yes.
How did the religious right do in the four states that have changed?
I have no idea. She's asking how did the religious right do in the four states that have changed. I don't know. I'm not really political, you know. I'm not. No, I'm not. This is a societal problem. Yeah. It concerns both the Republicans and the Democrats. Well, they're all guilty, and they all have to change. And that's why all of the bills, you know, we have a Republican, McCain is Republican, Feingold is Democrat, and in the House, Shays is Republican. Oh, no, it's the other way around, isn't it? Shays Republican. Shays Meehan. Meehan, I think, is the Democrat.
Question.
Yes.
Yes, you've been talking about what happened in Washington, D.C., and you've been admonishing us as citizens in the states to have four states. And you mentioned four states that did it. How did they do it? Did they lean on their politicians? Or did they demand a referendum? Or just how do you go about changing?
There are two ways you can do it. You can do it as a citizens' initiative, and that's and it's very, very difficult because you've got to get a certain number of signatures signed on a petition based on the population in your state. Or you can do it by getting the legislature to change. And 60% of the people in Massachusetts were in favor. They wanted it to happen. And then the governor refused to sign it. So they called me up. I was in Dallas. My son says we have to be very careful about bragging, Mom, but I have to tell this story. It's true. They called me. I was in Dallas. And this is the first time I had been asked to go off. Please come off your route and come and talk to the governor. And I said, oh, I can't do that. I've got to get finished in a year when I'm 90. And they said, well, are you out here to walk or out here to sell campaign finance reform? I said, I'll come. And I went there, and we didn't know whether anybody would know us or when we got to the station there in Boston. But there was a whole flanks of this thing. TV, and they stuck it in my face and said, what do you think of the governor now? And I said, what has he done? They said, he heard you were coming and he's signed the bill. So I said, I think he's a patriot, and I'm going to stand outside. I'm going to stand outside of his door and say so. So I went up to the, I went there and stood by his door until he came out, and I said, Governor, I think you're a patriot. He said, oh, yeah. Said, yes. And then he grinned. But then the Republicans, they didn't put money in the budget for it, money that was there, money that was in escrow. They didn't put it in. So last month, there were two men that ran on it anyway in Massachusetts, and the court last month made a decision, said, you've got to put money in there. You've got to put money in there. So it's very, very difficult because what the senator said to me, Ma, Doris, you're asking us to bite the hand that feeds us. Everybody in the House and in the Senate has been elected under this system. They know no other system. And they think that that's the only way to get elected. It's what they don't remember. I'm 92 and I remember how it was in the old days. You didn't have to ask people for money. You know, you went out from town to town in your district and you talked and you gave them your ideas and your vision and they elected you. Or the one that was the best, that had a good record and a good background, and that's how we elected the people in those days.
People I've spoken to who have worked on a lot of different issues know that at bottom, campaign finance, public funding has got to happen in the end.
That's right.
But meanwhile, everybody's off putting out this fire or that fire. You know, we're off trying to prevent an invasion of Iraq or trying to feed the hungry, homeless people. How do you get everybody from groups like that to put energy in?
Well, you see, it's the most important societal problem we have in this country today. I said before that I was not political, so you laughed and I forgot my train of thought. It is the most important societal problem we have in this country today, face it. We are letting the rich take over. We have only so much money in this country, right? We don't make money. We make money to replace the stuff that's no good, and we take that the stuff that's no good and put it in the trash. So if you spend the money for ephemeral things such as TV ads, that means that somebody's getting very rich, doesn't it? And that money is gone, and you haven't got it to put into schools, to put into infrastructure, to get a good health plan. It's not there. And it means that nothing is going to happen until we get that money out. Look, we give the government, now watch, this is very, I'll say it slowly because it's, and if you have any questions, you don't understand how it goes, please ask me. We give the government $1.4 trillion a year. $1.4 trillion a year. Of that, $150 billion a year is given for subsidies, for tax breaks, for special dispensations to rich men. Our tax dollars, $150 billion. Think about it. It would cost to run this public funding for the whole thing, $1.9 billion of that $150 billion that we're giving away. Now, a subsidy is not a loan. A subsidy is money given by the government to an entity or to a corporation whose product is for the good of all. For the good of all. and how many, and I don't know how many, how much we give for tobacco, but it sure as hell ain't good of all. But it's right there. We gave $9 billion so far for corn for growing for Enron, for what's that stuff? But that replaces gasoline. Ethanol. Poor Gibb. Now, ethanol is known not to work. They can put some as additive in, but there's a subsidy on that. They know how it stands. They've got this answer, but it is subsidized up to 2007. So there are some things that need to be subsidized. There's no doubt about it. But there are a lot of things. They put a subsidy on and then they forget about it. During the Korean War, which was some 50 years ago, during the Korean War, the government, in their wisdom, thought that it was always hot in Korea, that it would never get cold. And here are the poor kids out there with summer clothing, trying to fight the war. They didn't have enough wool available to make uniforms for those kids out there fighting in Korea in the cold. So they put a subsidy on anybody that would grow sheep to get the wool. And I had a girl that walked with me a month. And I said to her, "Who's taking care of your sheep while you're out here?" She said, "I don't raise sheep anymore." I said, "How come?" "Well," she said, "they took the subsidy off last year." Last year, and it had been on all that time. And I was in Texas, and I spent a night with a man and his wife. He had run a newspaper. He was now retired, but he was writing a column now and then for that newspaper. And he was burning up because he had just discovered this and found that Sam Donaldson was getting $95,000 a year for raising sheep. Now, it was perfectly legal. He just is a smart guy. $95,000 a year for 50 years. So, any other questions? How many shoes did you wear? That's what the kids want to know. I wore out 4 pairs of running shoes and 1 pair of boots, which I wore out in the desert. Along the desert, the line, it's rocks, little rocks the size of peas, and it hurts your feet, but so you had to wear boots. But I tell the kids, I walked 3,200 miles and wore out 4 pairs, so that's 800 miles apiece. And if their shoe is run down in the back, go to your mother and say, "Granny D says I've walked 800 miles in these. I need a new pair."
Okay.
Yes?
There's coffee and tea downstairs if you'd like to come now.
Doris Haddock, Granny D.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Like an